accession number 20303, reel 3.
John Goddard, reel 3.
And so, again, there was a shortage of training facilities, and so they had to use operational ships to send sailors to train them up. Now, I was designated to become a torpedo and anti-submarine rating, and I was sent to the destroyer called Cadiz. It was a battle-class destroyer, to learn about the torpedoes on board, the Aztecs on board, and, in fact, it was only going to be a 6 weeks' course. So really shortened, not very good course at all. But also, when I joined the Cadiz, we set sail from Portsmouth in company with another destroyer that's called the Sluice. And in the English Channel, we joined up with an aircraft carrier called the Vengeance. And on board there was Admiral Cunningham, the famous Admiral of World War II. And we were going on a courtesy visit to Norway. The Norwegians wanted to honour the Navy and Admiral Cunningham. And so we set sail for Oslo. And we got to Oslo and we were fated. And there was obviously reception with King Haakon in the palace. But we were taken off on trips and made a fuss of the ship's company of all the ships. And then we sailed along the entire coastline of Norway, visiting about 10 ports, Trondheim, Bergen, Narvik, and we at Tromso, and we ended up in Hammerfest, the most northern town of Europe. But all the time, it was what the Navy would call a jolly. It was a marvellous cruise. We were fated everywhere we went, and so the course we were supposed to be doing was rather shortened, rather scant. Anyway, came off that trip, and I've now called a torpedoman detector third class from this scant knowledge I'd obtained on the Cadiz during this cruise.
What kind of duties did that involve?
Well, when you qualified it, well, it then meant when you joined a ship, you joined the torpedo and submarine branch section. And so you could either be working on torpedoes and you would work on depth charges, you're responsible for the minesweeper, you did minesweeping, or else you could be, well, it was called Aztecs in those days, it's now called sonar, or else you could be a sonar operator. And in fact, I joined the ship as a torpedoman detector, third class, and called the Solbay. So this was now 1948. For a few months, and then I was then sent for what I hadn't done.
What was it like in that ship?
Oh, it was quite good. It's a good ship. Yeah, so they were very smart ships, actually, battle-class destroyers. People liked being on them because they were extremely smart ships, and you went to interesting places because they were smart ships. And anyway, what I hadn't actually done, although I had a brush with torpedoes and depth charge and things like that, I'd never done any submarine detecting, which I was required to do. So I was taken off the Solway, and I was sent to Portland, which was the anti-submarine training school there. And there, I used to go to ships every day, I mean, in training classes, and we learnt... did submarine detecting. We'd go out with submarine and we would chase it all day long. The familiar ping, ping, ping you see in those wartime films. And we did that.
Were you happy with this course that your career had taken in the Navy?
Yes, really, because you're young and single and you're very resilient. There's an expression that used to be in the Navy, home is where my hammock is. And it was easy as that. You were very happy-go-lucky.
What are your next memories?
Well, my next memory is, when I finished that course, I went into Chatham Barracks. And by now, I suppose I must have been about 19, 20. And the logical progression then is promotion. And leading seaman was a bit of the next step. I was an able seaman, become an able seaman then, which was automatic. But then the next step up was the leading seaman, which you had to qualify professionally for. That means you had to have an extra knowledge of rope work, parts of ship, damage control, sailing, rowing, anchors and cables. And you did this examination. Well, I was in Chatham Barracks, and I actually took the examination whilst I was in Chatham Barracks. I studied for it in Chatham Barracks and went on board one of the ships in the dockyard. They convened a board. About six of you ABs would go through. You'd be examined by the officer of the ship. And I passed for that, which was good. Then I met a couple of my old pals in there, and they were going to join submarines. And so they said, "Why don't you come along with us and join submarines?" Well, at the time, as an able seaman, I was getting 4 shillings a day pay. And submarine pay was 2 shillings and 6 pence a day extra, which means you're talking about a 60% increase in salary. In other words, about as much as a petty officer. So, free and easy. I said yes. So I then joined submarines in end of 1948.
Was it easy to be accepted for it?
Yes, well, you had to pass the medical, obviously. You had to be of good conduct. That was basically a requirement. But there's a great myth about submarines, about all members of submarine service are volunteers. Well, it's never been that. Since the submarine service existed, half of them are conscripts. They don't want to be in them, you know. But in my case, I was quite happy to go in them anyway.
And then?
Well, then I did my submarine training course, which again was sort of adventurous. You do the submarine escape, and you think you're a big hero, and all this sort of thing. Very macho. Well, what young men do. And then I joined my first submarine, which was the Alcide, running from Scotland, Rossi rather, on the Isle of Bute.
What was it like in this submarine?
Oh, it was fine. Yes, it was one of the newest class. It was roomy. They had been designed towards the end of the war, with more space than previously because they were designed for operations in the Pacific. And Pacific, very vast distances, so they had to be more comfortable. So they were quite pleasant submarines to serve on.
How do you spell Alcide?
Alcide. I think he was a Goth or somebody, Hun or people, ancient history.
What were your duties in this ship?
Well, I was now a torpedoman, detector third class, and I was a torpedoman on this ship. And whilst I'd been on there about, when I'd been on there about 9 months, my promotion, the leading seaman, came through. I was promoted to leading seaman. Well, in those days, it ended about 2 years afterwards because they couldn't do it. If because you had been serving with a group of chaps, one of the lads, if you got a promotion to leading seaman, which meant you were a corporal, it was thought, well, it's a bit uncomfortable. Suddenly you change from being one of the lads to giving them orders. So you used to get a change of ship, change of submarine. And so, because I'd made a leading seaman, I was then transferred to a submarine called the Tyrolese, operating from Northern Ireland.
The what?
Tyrolese. Tyrolese,
How do you spell it?
Tirelease.
How did that compare with Alcide?
Well, it was a T-class submarine, which is smaller. But we, on the Alcide, we made some longish trips on there. But on the Tyrolese, we just used to go to sea from Londonderry with a squadron of frigates who would then try and find us. And we'd come back in. So It was quite a settled routine. And we lived on board a landing craft in Londonderry. When we got in harbour, we lived on board a landing craft, which was quite pleasant.
Did you find submariners any different from other naval people?
In a way they are. They're more limited in their outlook. They lose sight of the larger world, I think. If you're on a surface ship, you tend to go more interesting places. And you do more different types of exercises and take part in more different events. Like a submarine, there's no ceremonial events. You know, when you enter harbour, you might be sent on a visit to carry a dignitary. You know, the ship's dressed overall, bugles are going, and things like that. Of course, there's none of that in submarines. You just go around scruffy old overalls all the time, you know. And of course, when you're at sea, other than the lookouts and the officer watch, nobody gets on the upper deck. So I find submarines have got a more limited outlook.
Were you ever frightened in a submarine?
No, not really. No. I mean, the time to be frightened, really, when you do submarine escape training, because you're shut in a very small area. And you're breathing in through the oxygen bag and opening up hatches. But, you know, if you've just got that mentality, you know. I mean, for example, I couldn't jump out of an aeroplane with a parachute. It's just the way you're made, isn't it?
What were the officers like in the submarine service?
Well, like most officers in the Royal Navy at the time, they were very self-centred. I mean, all they were basically interested in themselves. That's all you could really say, because there was a very strict division between upper and lower deck in the Navy at the time. A lot of class distinction. And by and large, they were indifferent to the sailors under them as the officers on service ships.
Can you explain a bit what you mean by that?
Well, the Navy ran, basically, a very strict discipline. And it was mainly brought about because you were like indentured men. You were on this long-serving engagement. And the Navy could do anything to you that it liked because you were trapped in it till you were 30. And this caused an attitude in the officers that they could tell you anything to do and treat you any way they liked because you couldn't do anything about it. And the great majority of officers were entirely indifferent to the way the sailors lived. And so you can't say anything different. There were some good ones, but they stood out. Yeah.
Were the officers resented then?
They were by and large, yes. Yeah. I mean, the sailors' name for officers were pigs. You know, you see a couple of officers, and each other say, "Oh, two pigs coming on board." Yeah. It was a great gulf.
Was anything ever done to hamper the work of officers?
No. But I mean, it wouldn't have worked anyway because the punishment regime was so swift that nobody would have got away with it anyway.
Were you punished?
No. If you kept your nose, you know, maybe you were just sensible. It didn't matter as long as you knew the system. Act green, keep clean used to be the motto.
It was what?
Act green, keep clean. That was 90% of the drill.
What do you mean by act green?
Well, pretend you didn't know what was going on, you know, and, you know, oh, I didn't know I was supposed to do that, you know, nobody told me sort of thing. Yeah.
What are your next memories, please?
Well, when I left the Tyrus, I had to get my second qualification, the torpedoman detector, and become a torpedoman detector second class. And I had this, what we call a draft chit, to this establishment called HMS Defiance. And I'd never heard of HMS Defiance. And because the main torpedo school in the Navy was HMS Vernon at Portsmouth. There was a smaller one at Chatham. But then when I asked around on the depot ship when I saw the Master at Arms, he said, oh, he said, that's a torpedo school in Plymouth. So I left Londonderry with a draft ship to go to Plymouth. Now, I was rather disappointed because my parents now lived in Southend. Well, I was hoping to get home to weekends, from Plymouth I couldn't. Anyway, I got to Plymouth. Then I got a handcart at the station. You didn't have lorries meeting in those days. Put my kit on it, wheeled it down to the barracks, and told the chief petty officer on the gate that I was going to Defiance. He said, right, you've got to go right through the barracks, down into the dockyard, the jetty there, and you'll get a boat across the Defiance. I thought, all right, long way away. Pushed my handcart down to the jetty. And I looked around across to Cornwall then, and a sailor came down. I said, excuse me, I said, I've been told I'm joining Defiance. Could you tell me where it is? And I was looking for a brick-built establishment. He said, see those three old hulks over there? And there were three hulks, and one nearest was just like the Victory. And the one behind it was just like the Victory, and one was an early warship. Anyway, when I got on there, the torpedo school for the Plymouth Division were these three old hulks. It was absolutely unbelievable.
Which year was it?
This would now be 1950. And I was on this first one, the Inconstant, was one of being a ship of the line. And we lived just like Nelson's days. Well, you did anyway, in big ships and in steel ships. But we had our mess table. And where the gun port was, where the cannon used to run through, they'd actually got round and they'd managed to put four panes of glass in there. You know, a window. And we were, and I thought, I don't believe this. You know, 1951. I'm living in a ship of the line. It was terrible. Yeah. They had a snooker, they had a canteen on the upper deck. It was like a tin shed at the top of it. They had two snooker tables in there. When the Liberty men used to fall in, anybody playing snooker, all the snooker balls used to run to one side of the ship because the ship would take up a list. It was most amazing, yeah. And so this was it, yeah. Anyway, since then, oh, it's been such a terrible shame because they were historic ships. One was the first steamship in the Royal Navy. Even then, it had the largest engine room afloat. It was called the Vulcan. I think it was the first fastest ship in the world at the time. They took them out to sea about 1957, 58, and blew them up. I mean, they were absolutely incredible ships in historical terms. Yeah, amazing. There we are. That was my course. There we are.
Did you learn much?
Yes, well, I did, yes. I was keen, and we used to enjoy it. I mean, we used to spend hours in the evenings with what we called our fare books, and we would, you know, spend hours drawing torpedoes and depth charges and minesweepers as sweeps out and colour them, you know, and, you know, our workbooks we used to do. And, you know, it was good. It was all right.
Why are they called fare books?
Well, when you went to your lectures, you just scribbled down quickly. And you did your sketches quickly. And then it's just a matter of pride. You then got a big book and did it up properly. Because, you would refer to them. Once you went to your ship, you would refer to them in your work.
And next?
Well, next, I returned to HMS Dolphin, which is a submarine base at Dolphin, the premier submarine base. And then I got what's called a draft ship to the submarine called HMS Affray, which was in, this was in April, beginning of April 1951. The Affray had been in dry dock under refit for 4 months. And when I joined it, there were only about 15 people in the crew. And I was on there a fortnight when we were due to leave Portsmouth Dockyard and come over to Dolphin and start operations, after the refit. Well, on the Sunday night, I was what they call duty watch on the submarine. We were living in HMS Dolphin, but we used to have a fire party on board the submarine at night, sleeping on board. And on the Sunday, I was duty watch, and so I was one of these fire party. And we were due to leave at dock 8 o'clock the next morning at the end of the refit. We tidied up the boat about 8 o'clock at night, and the duty officer of AFRAE was coming over from Dolphin, carry out an inspection, and then he would return to Dolphin. We would have stayed on board. Well, you've got two battery tanks on submarines, and you've got 122 cells in each. I believe that 120, 122, which gives you 220 volts, because the limited voltage to each battery. And they take up, they're underneath the floorboards of the accommodation space, and they're huge batteries. You know the council bins now, the one with wheels, they're about the size of that, lead acid made by Exide, huge heavy batteries, they're under these floorboards. Well, because they're full of acid, it's possible for a battery to leak. And the deck is deliberately sloped, and there's a little sump in one corner of each battery. Now, twice a day on a submarine, an electrician goes along, and with a piece of string, he lowers some litmus paper into this sump. If acid had leaked, it would come up, and it would discolour the litmus paper. Well, we'd finished our tidying up, and we were sitting in the mess, just yarning or whatever we were doing, reading. And the leading electrician came in the mess. He'd just done his work. And he said, "We won't be leaving dock tomorrow." So we said, "Why is that?" And Slinger, his name was Woods, Slinger Woods. He said, "I've just found oil in number one battery tank." And what he'd done, he'd lowered his piece of string with litmus paper to see if it was acid. When he pulled it up, it was soaking in oil. Well, he phoned up the duty officer and told him. Next morning, he was quite right, we didn't leave dockyard. We had all these dockyard inspectors come on board. We had senior engineer officers come on board. They had meetings in the wardroom and talk about what to do. And then we were told to lift up the batteries, the number one battery tank, which meant taking all the furniture out, overhead sort of chain cranes, and we lifted up the batteries. And got them out, and then the dockyard inspectors went in there and they looked at the battery tank. And we were convinced we wouldn't go to sea, because oil was leaking. Anyway, that afternoon, there were meetings held ashore in the different offices, but then we were told at 4 o'clock to put the batteries back in the battery tank, which we did do. And at 7 o'clock at that night, we sailed across to Dolphin. And we were amazed that we were about 20 chaps on board then, that we'd left the dockyard because there's some oil problem. Now, we then come to the Tuesday, we come to the Wednesday, and we got to the Friday. With half a crew, we went to sea, off the Isle of Wight, and we dived. We went down periscope depths and we ran different machinery, make sure it worked and everything else like that. Then we went down to 90 feet. You can't go any deeper than that because you'll hit the bottom. And then we surfaced about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Now, when we surface, you have two indicator buoys, forward and aft, on the submarine's casing. They're kept enclosed by two wooden hatches. And these two wooden hatches, they're released by, you turn a wheel inside the submarine, which is on a spindle, and then by turning, the spindle rotates, and then in the casing, it withdraws a metal plate that is in two grooves cut into these two gratings. And once you remove this metal plate, it's about 4 inches long. Once that's withdrawn, these wooden hatches can come open and these indicator buoys float free on a reel of wire. When we surfaced, the after indicator buoy had come adrift. And a chap named Warris and I went down on the casing, hauled this buoy in and put it back in this position in the casing. And then we came back into harbour. When we got into harbour, the following day, because the hatch was distorted, we actually, him and I, in fact, again, we lashed that with wire. First attempt, I'd lashed that with wire because it's up a bit until we can get it fixed. Now, on the Monday, the submarine was going to sea. Now, it had only gone to sea with half a ship's company. The other half of the ship's company had never been on the submarine before and was coming off leave that Monday, right? So there were going to be a crew of about 56 men on board when it went to sea. On top of that, the submarine service took in each year an entry of submarine officers, the ordinary officers with no qualifications who could go for gunnery, navigation, fleet air arm, or whatever. But the ones that volunteered to be submarine officers would joined as a class, and they do about 3 months training and lectures and day trips on submarines. The culmination of their training, 25 of them, this is a submarine intake for that particular year for the submarine officer, they go on what they call a week's cruise on a submarine, and they were going on the Afray. So that Monday afternoon, we were going to sail at 4 o'clock with these 25 officers. They weren't submarine officers, they were being trained, culmination of their training. And they were going to do what we call seamen's jobs. They were going to do lookouts, they were going to be on the wheel, they were going to do messenger, those sort of jobs, just to familiarise themselves with life on a submarine and what the sailors did on the submarine. That was the situation. Also, we were going to take 4 Royal Marines with 2 canoes on a trip, and they were going to sail on Monday afternoon. They were going to land near Falmouth on Wednesday, and they were going to shore to do one of their raids. So what happened on the Monday was, at noon, the sailors who had never been on something before joined the ship. So half the ship's company had never been on there before. The captain then cleared lower deck to talk to his brand new ship's company, because he'd never met me before. You know, most of us were new. And he told us what we were going to do. We were going to sail at 4 o'clock with these officers, these Royal Marines. And he said, unfortunately, he said, because we're going to be terribly overcrowded, we're going to have 29 people extra on board. I've got to leave some people behind. He said, well, I've got to take my sonar operators. Well, I was a torpedoman detector. I could have been a sonar operator on there. He said, all I can leave is my torpedoman behind, because we hadn't kept carrying any torpedoes. And he said, the 2 gunnery ratings. Well, it so happened, when I joined it a fortnight before, I'd asked the senior torpedoman on board, if I could be the torpedoman on there. Because there was a torpedoman compartment aft where I would have looked after torpedoes. And he said, well, you're first on board. He said, sure. Then another leading seaman, torpedoman, joined on that Monday. And the first thing he said to me, he said, I've got to be sonar. Well, I said, that's right, Smudger. I said, well, he said, I've been sonar every submarine I've been on. He said, I wanted to be torpedo aft airman. I said, well, that's all right. I said, we'll swap round in 6 months' time, if you like. And then I'll do sonar. I said, we've got to keep our skills up. So that was the arrangement. So I was a torpedoman on there. Anyway, captain said, got to leave torpedoman behind and got to leave the gunnery ratings behind. He left a signalman behind as well. We let her go at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. She sailed round to the Isle of Wight,